Let's turn back to Exodus now. We start left off last time at chapter 23. And again, we're doing an overview of the law section in Exodus. And what we're going to look at this hour is we'll finish up the laws. And again, we're doing an overview. I'm not going into each law in detail because we're not under the law. We can learn from them. So I do encourage you to read these sections in detail. If you have any questions, be sure and come and ask. And I'll give you the overview. But this hour, we'll finish that up. And we'll look at Israel's ratification of the law. Israel actually ratified this. It wasn't like the Abrahamic covenant. The Mosaic covenant is different, and I'll summarize that at the end of the hour. But first, let's finish up the judgments. And remember, the law is broken down into three sections. First, we had the commandments, the Ten Commandments, and that was in Exodus 19 and 20. 19 was the preamble, 20 was the commands themselves. And then we have the judgments, and that's what we're working on now. That's in chapters 21 through 23. And we'll finish, hope to do two chapters this hour. As I said, we're doing an overview of this. And then the ordinances, and that'll start in chapter 25. So 23 ends the judgments pretty much. 24 is the transition point of the whole book of Exodus. It transitions from the law to the ordinances. Well, I guess they're part of the law, but we'll be looking, the main subject of the rest of the book will be the tabernacle and the worship system that God initiated to nation Israel. So that will be Israel's religious life governed by law. And actually, that'll go from Exodus chapter 25 clear through Leviticus. And a lot of these laws that we've looked at last week and last hour are fleshed out in those books. In the rest of the Torah, we have much more detail about these laws. And that's another reason I kind of overviewed them, because they're filled out in detail in the rest of the Torah. We could call chapter 23, verses 1 through 9, the good neighbor laws. And most of the cases in this section are apodictic. Remember what apodictic means? It's a statement. It's not a, if somebody does this, then this happens. This is just a statement of fact, a direct statement. Now, last hour, if you were here, we ended off with the last section of chapter 22, and it governed or talked about love, compassion for the weak, the poor, the elderly, and the aliens. And now we're going to turn from that to an exhortation to justice. So it kind of fits together. Last section said, be kind when you're dealing with poor, when you're dealing with the aliens, the weak. You're to be kind to those. This section is going to say, don't take that to the point of not having justice. So it's a kind of the counterpoint to the last section we just had. Because the demands of justice are this. First, in verse 2, justice demands impartiality and not compliance with what everybody else thinks. I mean, justice is justice. It doesn't matter if everybody else in the universe thinks you're wrong. Justice is justice. It's just that simple. We've lost this concept in our country because we're a democratic country. We have, you know, we vote on what's moral and what's right and what's wrong. But justice is justice. Israel didn't get an opportunity to draft these laws and vote on them. God just gave them the laws because it was a demonstration of his perfect justice. So again, and I say this quite often, but when people ask me, do you think the death penalty is a deterrent? My response is always, it doesn't matter. It's a matter of justice. If someone wrongfully takes a life that was created in the image of God, then there has to be justice. He has to forfeit his own life. It's simple justice. It has not a deterrent. I think it is, but that's just my opinion. It doesn't matter if it is or not. So justice demands impartiality, no matter what anybody else thinks. Verse 2 says, you shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. So if you lie to be politically correct, for example, then you're not supposed to do that, is what this verse is saying. Don't follow the crowd. Follow justice. Justice cannot be negated purely for the sake of compassion. We should be compassionate, of course, as believers. But we can't negate justice, because if we do that, then we're compromising God's position. And that's going to lead us to thinking God isn't just then. So then there was no death required for sins, because God is compassionate. And you'll hear that. People, oh, God is a loving God. God is love. He's compassionate. He would never send anyone to hell. That's illogical, because God is also just. So he's saying you have to balance your compassion with justice. Justice and fairness supersedes personal relationships. Look at verse 6. It says, you shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in his dispute. So you can't pervert justice just because a person is poor and you feel sorry for them. You know, I could feel sorry for someone, and I say this in all seriousness. I could feel compassion for someone. I could feel sorry for someone while I was pulling the switch on the electric chair that's going to execute them. I can do that because compassion does not override justice. And we used to know that as a country. I know that. I've got a kind of a thing for old radio shows, and I have this collection of old radio shows that before television. And I remember, I shouldn't admit that, but I remember gathering around at my grandmother's house, and she had one of those big old radios, you know, that was about that high. And The Shadow was one of my favorites, of course. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men. Anyway, in one of these Shadow episodes, there was a kid on death row. He had been convicted of murder, and he wanted to talk to the Shadow. Well, the Shadow could cloud men's minds, so he could get in and talk to this kid. And the Shadow was in there talking to him, and the kid said, look, I just want to tell you that I'm not a bad kid. You know, I got caught up with a bad crowd, and I want them to pay, too, for what they've done, so I'm going to tell you about them. And the Shadow said to him, that's really good, but you killed a man, you have to die. I mean, that was right on the radio show. And the kid said, you know, and he felt compassion for the kid. And the kid said, I know that. It's justice. He said, I got caught up in the wrong company. This just kind of happened. But you killed a guy wrongfully. Interesting how our culture has changed over the course of my short lifetime. Hush. Now in verses 10 through 19, we get to the Sabbath laws. And this kind of infringes or overlaps, I should say, chapters 25 and so forth, because it's talks about the religious life of nation Israel. And, you know, I think God does this just to mess up my outlines. He'll put something in a section that kind of overlaps with another section. But laws on the Sabbath year and the Sabbath day in chapter 23, verse 10 through 19. Verse 10 says, you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield. But on the seventh year, you shall let it rest and lie fallow so that the needy of your people may eat, and whatever they leave of the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. So every seventh year, they had a Sabbath year, not only a Sabbath day every week, but every 7 years, they had a Sabbath year when they were not supposed to plant crops, not supposed to work. They were supposed to let the land regenerate, and they were supposed to let the animals be able to feed off of the land, and that was the Sabbath. Verse 12, 6 days you are to do your work. On the seventh day you shall cease from labor, so that your ox and your donkey may rest. For the son of your female slave, as well as your stranger, may refresh themselves. Now, concerning everything which I have said to you, be on your guard, and do not mention the name of other gods, nor let them be heard from your mouth. Now, in verse 14, he starts on the three major events in the year of Israel, the three pilgrimage feasts, as they're called. He says, verse 14, three times a year you shall celebrate a feast to me. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread for 7 days. You are to eat unleavened bread as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. You shall also observe the feast of the harvest. That's the second feast. Of the first fruits of your labors from what you sow in the field. Also the feast of ingathering. So there's the third. So we have three major feasts in Israel's religious life. Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord God. And that meant come to the tabernacle. And when the temple was in Jerusalem, the male Jews over 13 had to come to Jerusalem three times a year for these festivals, these feasts, because they were the big three, you might call them. First one is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In verse 15, you shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now remember this, we've gone through it before. It started immediately after Passover. They had the Seder, the Passover meal, and then they would, the following week would be the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And that took place at the beginning of the barley harvest. That's why they call it the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Immediately after the Passover, and it was at the beginning of the barley harvest in the spring. Now this commemorated the Exodus. That was the purpose of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Passover and unleavened bread commemorated the Exodus. Remember, the Passover commemorated the angel of death passing over the Jewish houses that had blood on the doorpost, and the leavened bread represented they had to leave in a hurry. They didn't have time to allow their bread to rise. So that was the purpose of this feast. It was a commemoration of the Exodus. Then we have the Feast of the Harvest. Feast of the Harvest, also called the Feast of Weeks. It's also called the Day of First Fruits. Sometimes it's called Pentecost because it takes place 50 days after the second day of Passover. So Pentecost, Penta means five. 50 days after the second day of Passover, they would celebrate the Feast of the Harvest, so they called it Pentecost. That's what they were celebrating when Peter made his speech in the book of Acts, and the Holy Spirit fell on these people, and that's what began the church. When you hear the church began on the day of Pentecost, this is what they were celebrating at that time, the Feast of the Harvest, or the Feast of Weeks, Pentecost, 50 days after the second day of Passover. This commemorated the giving of the law. So now we've commemorated the Exodus and the giving of the law. Verse 16 says, you shall observe the feast of the harvest of the first fruits of your labor from what you sow in the field. Also the feast of ingathering. And that's the third feast. Third feast is kind of interesting. I have some photographs. The third feast is called the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths. You may have heard it called. You've heard that one, right? The Feast of Tabernacle or the Feast of Booths. What happened was they would live in a, well, they still do. I mean, this feast is still celebrated in Israel. And they lived in booths or tents, tabernacles, to commemorate their wandering in the wilderness. That's what this feast was for. Last part of verse 16, it says, also the feast of ingathering at the end of the year when you gather in the fruit of your labors from the field. So that commemorates their desert wanderings. Now this is a booth. This is actual current day modern. You can see the lawn chairs out there. Very attractive, comfortable place. Now some of the Jews only ate there, and some of them actually slept there and lived there for the whole week. But that's a matter of personal beliefs, I think, in Judaism. But some people are more strict than others. They would live in their booths. Now, this is a nice one. In downtown Jerusalem, where people are kind of packed together, they have a little different booths. This is one in downtown Jerusalem that I wouldn't want to sleep in, the one on the left. They'd probably have to lean me against the wall or something, but they can be made out of anything. They can be made out of tent material, or here we see plywood with corrugated metal for the tops, but it's just a temporary dwelling. Some of them don't even have sides. They're just four poles with a roof over it. And it commemorates the wandering in the wilderness because they didn't have a permanent dwelling. So for this week, they move out of their homes, some of them, into a temporary dwelling to remember that Israel was in the wilderness for 40 years. And that's the purpose of the feast, Feast of Tabernacles or Booths. I thought those photos were kind of interesting, so I just put them in there. Now, back to the judgments, we'll look at the epilogue in verses 20 through 33, and this epilogue concludes the entire book of the covenant. And in this epilogue, Israel is promised an angel of God, every protection and success, provided they remain faithful to the covenant. See how this is different from the Abrahamic covenant? The Abrahamic covenant didn't say provided anything. But the Mosaic covenant does. It says you will be protected, successful, if you abide by the covenant. And verse 20, it says, behold, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him. Obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, since my name is in him. Now, who is this angel of God then? Look at some of his attributes that are mentioned here, and you see that it says he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. Who has the power to pardon transgressions? We just learned that in Mark, remember? In Mark, Jesus, when they lowered the paralytic in the pallet. They lowered it down into the house, and he said, "Child, your sins are forgiven." And the religious leaders went bonkers when he did that. Hey, only God can forgive sins. And they were right. They just didn't believe that Jesus was God, and he was. So God says, "I'm going to send you an angel, and he won't pardon your transgressions." So that implies he has a right to pardon your transgressions. So who is the angel? He says, "My name is in him." And obedience to this angel will result in all of the blessings that are listed here. And Israel is commanded not to rebel against him. So who do you suppose it can be? Well, Israel does just that. And this is the grace part. You know, people think, oh, they were under the law. That was so horrible. God was always a gracious God. He always will be a gracious God, because he's asking them not to rebel against this angel, and they turn around and do it. I mean, they just do it. Look at Numbers 14. Numbers 14 in verse 11, it says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'How long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst?'" Total rebellion. Psalm 78. Psalm 78, verse 17 says, "Yet they still continued to sin against him, to rebel against the Most High in the desert." So there they were in the desert. That's when the angel of God was with them, protecting them, making them successful, and they weren't to rebel against him. What did they do? They rebelled against him. Verse 40 of that same psalm says, "How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert." Verse 56, "Yet they tempted and rebelled against the Most High God." So that's a picture of Israel. And we're going to see in chapter 24 when Moses reads the law to them, they're going to say, "I agree. I'll do it. I will totally do everything God says." And by chapter 32, they're going to be in total rebellion against God. Again, asking somebody to make a commitment before they're a believer, we can't even make commitments after we're believers. You know, if you come up here and rededicate your life to Christ, you know what's going to happen? It's going to make a liar out of you. I'm sorry, but I think people tend to underestimate the power of our sin nature. Because, you know, it's powerful. I look inside myself and I don't see a pretty sight. I don't know if that's just me or if I'm overly critical of myself, but I don't deserve any of this. God is gracious, just like he was to Israel. And he's going to take Israel, who rebel against him time after time after time after time, and he'll be gracious to them time after time after time after time. Because that's the way God is. He's a gracious God. So who is the angel of God? It's got to be none other than the second person of the Godhead, because it isn't God. He said, "I will send an angel." So it's got to be Jesus Christ that was with Israel during their desert wanderings and who they rebelled against. Remember, we looked at the angel of the Lord in Genesis. We looked at that phrase, and that refers to Jesus Christ as well. Back to Exodus now. In addition to the angel, God said he's going to send confusion on all the enemies of Israel. How could they possibly rebel against this? He promised them, I'm going to send you an angel. That angel will protect you. He will make you successful, and I'll confuse your enemies. And what do they do when they get to the border of the promised land? Oh, these guys are too strong. We can't defeat them. God promised. He promised to protect them, make them successful, to send his angel, to send confusion into his enemies. And verse 23, it says, he will completely destroy them. It says, for my angel will go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I will completely destroy them. Now, what does he mean by that? Is he going to wipe them out and kill them all? Not exactly. What he means is he's going to wipe them out as a nation. These people will be confused. They will be a ragtag army. They won't be a nation. They won't have the unity of nation to fight against Israel when Israel enters the land. He even says the worship of God is going to affect their water and food supply, their health, their lifespan. Everything in Israel was geared around their God. Daily life in Israel was geared around God. We could learn a lesson from that. But they were to, remember we looked at last week, they were to talk about him in their house, they were to think about him all the time, and that God was to be the central feature of the household, of the family. Look at verse 25. It says, but you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and water, and I will remove sickness from your midst. So their spiritual life had a direct relationship to their health and well-being. Still they rebelled. Now, chapter 24 is the ratification, the recording of the covenant. Chapter 24 is the transition point, as I mentioned before, in the whole book of Exodus. Once the covenant is ratified, the tabernacle will become the most prominent subject in the book. From chapter 25 on, we'll be talking about the tabernacle. That'll be the central feature. Chapter falls into two divisions. Chapter 24, first, we'll have a divine call. God will summon Moses up to the mountain, and then he'll come back and read the law, and Israel will ratify it. That's verse 1 through 11. Israel, to a man, will ratify the covenant of God. And then in verses 12 through 18, we'll have the recording of the covenant, where, again, Moses is called up into the mountain, and God says, I'm going to record this covenant for you. Now, the narrative in chapter 24 continues from way back in chapter 20 and verse 21. Remember, back in chapter 20, it says, Moses said to the people, verse 20, do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you, and in order that the fear of him may remain with you so that you may not sin. So the people stood at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. So that's where we left off. And from then, from 2022 through 2333, we've been looking at the Book of the Covenant, what God told to Moses. And now we're going to continue that narrative portion where we get back to the people and Moses. It's not just God talking and giving the rules. It's now we're back to the narrative. So the first thing God tells them is that they are to come up to the mountain. It says, then he said to Moses, come up to the Lord. I'm back at chapter 24 now. you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, those are Aaron's two oldest sons, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Now, why do you bring Aaron and his two sons with him? Who is going to be the priesthood? Aaron's line, remember? The priesthood followed Aaron's line. So when God called Moses up, he called Aaron and his two sons because they would, they're not yet, but they would be appointed as the official priesthood of nation Israel, the line of Aaron, and the 70 elders. They were the leaders. Now, they had to sit back while Moses approached God. So Moses was the mediator between man and God. There was just one. It was Moses. The others had to stand back at a distance. Just like now, we have one mediator between man and God. I think that King James in the book of Job calls it a handsman. What that means is we have a mediator, and that mediator is Jesus Christ, and he takes our hand and he takes God's hands and he puts them together. He is our mediator. Just like Moses was the mediator at this time. And Moses prepares Joshua. Well, God prepares Joshua to take his place. So Moses alone act as mediator. You know, in Hebrews chapter 3, Jesus Christ is compared to Moses, our high priest. So Jesus Christ is the mediator now, but it's not the mediator of the Mosaic covenant. It's the mediator of the new covenant. So we changed mediators as we changed dispensations. He's Jesus Christ. Look at Hebrews chapter 12. But God always had a mediator. And it was Moses, then it was the high priest who was from the line of Aaron. And then at the new covenant, it's Jesus Christ. What do we say when we have communion? This cup is the new covenant in my blood. So we're under a new covenant. Our new mediator is Jesus Christ. And in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 24, it says, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood, which speaks better than the blood of Abel. Now, we're going to see the sprinkled blood here as part of the ceremony, too, of ratification of the Mosaic covenant. So back to Exodus now. You see how God always has a mediator between himself and man. Jesus is our mediator. He takes our hand and puts our hand in God's hand. We can't get to God apart from Jesus Christ. Now, if we go back to Exodus, we'll talk about the ratification of the covenant, and that's verses 1 through 11. If we look at verse 3, it says, then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice. So what happened is they're going to agree to this covenant, and in verse 8 it calls it, it says, so Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance to all these words. So it's the covenant between Yahweh, the Lord, and nation Israel. That's the covenant. So the book then, Moses is going to open the book and read it to all the people for their approval, basically. Verse 4, it says, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. So we have Moses writing it down. And what he's talking about there, all the words of the Lord, that's what we've been studying in chapter 20, 22 through the end of chapter 23. The laws, the stuff we've just looked at. The Ten Commandments, the civil ordinances, and we haven't gotten to the tabernacle part yet. But that's what he read to them, all that he had heard, which the Lord had spoken to him. Now notice the vote is unanimous. In verse 3, it says, he recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. This points out why the law was necessary. They thought they could do it. The law was necessary to point out to these people that you can't be righteous on your own. They thought they could. I'll do everything the law says. And they were absolutely unanimous about it. And, you know, they had the idea that they could obtain a righteousness of their own. And that's what the law was given to teach us, that we can't obtain righteousness on our own. This ratification then, after the vote, they had a unanimous vote, and that ratified their part, and it prepared for the conclusion of the covenant. Now we're going to have a ceremony to conclude the covenant. We call it the official response to the covenant in verse 4 through 8. Verse 4 says, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. He sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So they said it again. They're officially affirming the covenant. So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on all the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. That's all that we've been studying and more, as we'll learn later when we get into the rest of the Torah, as those rules are expanded on. So that was the official ratification. Now, the first thing, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord, and that would be for preserving them as an official record of the covenant. Then, Moses built an altar at the foot of the mountain, altar of earth. Remember back in chapter 20, look back in 20, where we picked up from in chapter 20, verse 24, it said, you shall make an altar of earth for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offering. So, see how we're picking up that narrative? Now Moses is building that altar that God told him to build. So, he builds an altar at the foot of the mountain. He also builds 12 boundary stones or pillars for the 12 tribes. Now the altar indicated the presence of God. It's an altar of God. Now, it was temporary at that time. And the 12 pillars were placed there to indicate where the 12 tribes would stand when Moses did this ceremony. And also, it represented their presence at the ratification of this covenant. Now, you see the total difference between this and the Abrahamic covenant? Look back at Genesis 15 just for a second. In Genesis 15, First of verse 12. Verse 12 says, "Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him." So he fell asleep. God brought a sleep upon him. God made him fall asleep. As my friend the anesthetist always likes to say, God was the first anesthetist. So God put Abraham to sleep. And then what happened? Well, look at verse 17 and 18. It says, "It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between the pieces." And they were pieces of the sacrificial animals that Abraham had gathered for God, and they cut them in two, as was the habit of making covenants in those days. Normally, two people, hand in hand, went down between the two rows of cut animals, and that sealed the covenant. Well, Abraham was asleep. God went through by himself. That's what we call an unconditional covenant. Abraham had nothing to do with it. God promised Abraham, and Abraham believed God, and what? It was reckoned to him as righteousness. So all he had to do was believe. Now, God made this covenant himself. That's the difference between the Mosaic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant. Now, in the Mosaic covenant, go back to Exodus, what does it say? If you obey, then I will bless. The Abrahamic covenant said the blessing of salvation is totally unconditional. All you have to do is believe me. And he saved Abraham because Abraham believed him. He saved nation Israel because they believed him when they left Egypt. Now, we have the covenant here in the Mosaic covenant, we call it, and Israel is ratifying it. They're doing their part on the covenant. So then, back to the Mosaic covenant now. The sacrifices were gathered and killed. In verse 5 and 6, it says, "He sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord." And then Moses takes half the blood, and he sprinkles half on the altar, and half he puts in pots. So then the covenant is ceremonially ratified by the people. They already promised before, but now this is the official promise in verse 7, "And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient." And they were absolutely serious, I have no doubt. Just like the people who commit their lives to Christ are, I believe they're absolutely serious. They mean that. But, you know, they underestimate the power of the sin nature. So the covenant was ratified by the people. Then he took the blood that he had saved in the two pots and he sprinkled it on the people. Now that makes shedding blood, it connects it with the grace of God. So here we have that connection. There's always, always, always blood has to be shed, no matter what. That's why when Adam and Eve covered themselves with leaves, God says that won't do. So he killed animals and covered them with animal skin. There's always, always, always blood associated with God's grace. And we have to get that drilled into our head, because here in our dispensation, the blood of Christ is what we're talking about. And we have to connect that blood of Christ with the grace of God. How do we get saved? By the blood of Christ. Not by anything we can do or say or pray or anything else. We're saved by the blood of Christ, because God's grace is connected with blood. In verse 9 through 11, this is kind of interesting. First, before we get into the second part of this chapter, Moses and Aaron and his two oldest sons And again, because they're going to be appointed as the priesthood of Israel, and the 70 elders, they went and had the covenant meal, and that was part of the ceremony. So they went and had supper with God. Look at verse 9. It says, "Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, and they saw God, and they ate and drank." So they had dinner with God. How would you like to be able to tell your kids, "Yeah, I had dinner with God," and not be lying? Now, what they saw was not God himself. It was a representation of God. Why do I say that? Because we'll see later, Moses is going to ask God, "Can I see you? Because I've never seen you before." Well, he was here then. So that must not have been God in person, but a representation of his glory. And you can see that in the context when he goes back up the mountain to record the covenant. In verse 16, "The glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai." And that word glory is the same word as Shekinah. You've heard of the Shekinah glory of God. That's a representation of him. It was the thing that was above the Ark of the Covenant, the glory of God. So they're not seeing God himself. They're seeing a representation of him. Besides, the New Testament says no man has ever seen God. So now we go to the recording of the covenant. After they had the ceremonial meal, they did the ceremony with the sprinkling of blood on the altar. You didn't think we'd get through the book of Exodus without that picture, did you? If you did, you don't know me very well. So now we have the recording of the covenant in verse 12 through 18. And that prepares the way for the rest of the book of Exodus. That paves the way, because now that we have the covenant recorded, now Moses gets called back up to the mountain and God gives him instructions on how to build the tabernacle. And that's what's going to be the subject of the rest of the book of Exodus. So we have the recording of the covenant and Moses receives instructions. If you look at verse 12, it again begins with a call for Moses to come up to the mountain. It says, "Now the Lord said to Moses, 'Come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction.'" Now, just before we leave, I want to make one more point. The Abrahamic and Mosaic covenants. And we've covered this before. I'll just fly over it. There are two features of the Abrahamic covenant that differ from the Mosaic covenant. The first is the grounds of the covenant was faith. Faith alone. Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. So when Abraham believed God, God gave him righteousness. The righteousness of God. So the grounds of that covenant was faith. Here in the Mosaic covenant, God says, "If you obey my commands, then I will bless you." So it's not the same thing. And the responsibility of salvation was obedience. That's how we live today. Just like everybody, throughout time, God has based salvation on faith. And then as Christians, we have a responsibility to be obedient. Some do and some don't. I understand that, but that's our responsibility, is to be obedient. We have to know what God wants before we can be obedient, and that's why we're here this morning. So, grounds was faith, the responsibility was obedient, and the relationship between the Mosaic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant is given in Galatians 3:19. It says the law was added. So the law, the Mosaic covenant, was added. It didn't replace the Abrahamic covenant, or the covenant of grace, as it's called, grace, by Paul in Galatians. It was added in Galatians 3:19 because of transgressions. Remember, we went through this, so I won't go in detail, but the word translated because of in Galatians 3:19 is the Greek word charon, and it means on account of or for the sake of. It means for the sake of defining transgressions, pointing out transgressions, to mark off transgressions. That's the purpose of the law, what we've been looking at. The purpose of the law is to reveal God's perfect justice and to point out that if we don't meet that criteria from the day we're born till the day we die, then we are not suited to be in the presence of God, because God is a holy God. And most people say that God can't stand to have unholy people in his presence. I think it's the opposite. We can't stand holiness because we're not. That's why we need the cross of Jesus Christ. So, the law was added for the purpose of defining transgressions. So if you think of the Abrahamic covenant, think of it as an unbroken line, and then think of the Mosaic covenant as being a parallel line. It was added to it. It's not replace it. It's not part of it. It was added to it, and it was added to do a job that the Abrahamic covenant couldn't do. The Abrahamic covenant did not point out transgressions. It pointed out you can be saved just by believing God. You need to know you need to be saved. And that's the purpose of the law. That worked for Paul, remember? He said in Romans 7, I believe it was, that, you know, I didn't even know what coveting was until there was a law. And then when I heard about it, my coveter went crazy. I started coveting everything, because my sin nature just loves to be rebellious and disobedient. So that was the law's job, was to do something that the Abrahamic covenant did not. And the most important thing to remember, and after we've studied the law, is that the law does not invalidate the Abrahamic covenant. Nothing invalidates the Abrahamic covenant because it was unconditionally given to Abraham by God. Abraham was asleep when that covenant was ratified. He had nothing to do with it. There were no strings attached. And God promised him what? Salvation. He had the righteousness of God. He promised him a land and a posterity. So if you hear people say, well, you know, Israel rejected Christ, so the church replaces Israel in God's program. That's called the doctrine of replacement. If that's the case, God lied to Abraham, because he didn't say, you'll get this land if you receive my Messiah. He said, you will get this land. So you have to accuse God of being a liar if you say that the church replaces Israel in God's plans. Next time we'll look at the tabernacle. Father, thank you for your word. In Christ's name, amen.